This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Police shootings always raise questions. Why the shooting happened, whether it should have happened, and who should be held accountable. Those questions could start getting clearer answers with a new federal database coming online. 2018 ended with two cases that highlight the need for clarity. Back in November, a man tried to shove past a security guard at a bar in Chicago. That man had gotten into a fight, been thrown out of the bar, and came back with a gun. Now, the security guard, Jamel Roberson, grabbed him, put his knee in the guy's back, and detained him for the police. When officers arrived, they opened fire and killed the security guard.
Roberson, who is black, was wearing a security vest, and witnesses say people in the crowd yelled to arriving police that Roberson was a guard. Still, one responding officer shot him, who later died at the hospital.
Less than 2 weeks after that, a gunfight broke out in a mall in Hoover, Alabama, that's near Birmingham. An 18-year-old was shot and a stray bullet hit a 12-year-old girl. Police officers shot and killed a young man named Emantic E.J. Bradford Jr. They initially said that Bradford was the gunman.
But over the weekend, that story dramatically changed. And now police here in Hoover, Alabama, just south of Birmingham, say they do not believe that it's likely that Bradford fired those shots at all. And that the shooter
Bradford was shot three times in the back. Witnesses say that he had a loaded handgun and was directing people to safety. Now, the NRA has made waves with a statement, the only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. But one out of four gun owners is African American. What happens when they're the good guys? Joining us in studio is Wesley Lowery, a national reporter with the Washington Post covering law enforcement, justice, and public policy. He'll walk us through that new federal database a little bit later in the program. Wesley, welcome back to 1A.
So great to be with you.
Also joining us are two guests with perspectives on the complex relationship between African Americans and firearms. In Pensacola, Florida, Cedric Alexander is a CNN law enforcement analyst. He is formerly the public safety director in DeKalb County, Georgia, which includes Atlanta, and the former president of NOBLE, the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives. Cedric, welcome.
Hello. Nice being with you here this morning. Thank you.
Also with us in Tulsa, Oklahoma, R.J. Young is a sports commentator and an NRA-certified firearms instructor. His new book is called Let It Bang, A Young Black Man's Reluctant Odyssey into Guns. R.J., glad to have you with us.
What's up, Joshua?
Thanks, RJ. Glad to thank you for making it. You are the most exuberant guest we have ever had from the jump on the show, and I love it. And we'd also love to get some of your questions and thoughts about the relationship between African Americans and firearms, particularly if you are a gun owner of color, what your journey has been like, whether you used to own firearms and don't anymore, or whatever questions or thoughts you may have. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Before we dive in with Wesley Lowery on some of the statistics regarding police-involved shootings, let me start with R.J. Young and Cedric Alexander and kind of lay a foundation for your relationships with firearms. Cedric Alexander, talk to us about how you became acquainted with guns, when you received your first firearm and what that was like.
Well, that was a very long time ago, 1977, when I started my career as a police officer in Tallahassee, Florida. So over the last 41 years of my career, most recently retired from public life, I've always been in the possession of firearms. I'm a supporter of the Second Amendment, and I believe in the right to be able to carry a firearm, but being able to carry one responsibly. And I think the majority of the people in this country who are owners of firearms conduct themselves, I think, in a way that it was meant to be. But of course, we always have those, always will have those, will go outside of the law and outside of the Constitution. And it creates a great deal of challenges and raises a great deal of questions, such as the question being raised here today in regards to how do we confront the complexity of firearms in our society, particularly around issues of race.
R.J. Young, what about you? You tell the story and have told the story about how you kind of became more acquainted with firearms as it related to your ex-father-in-law. Was that your first encounter with firearms up close?
Yes, it was. I knew guns is something that could get me killed and were warned by folks like Sid. You know, those were the people that had firearms, those in the military. So when my ex-father-in-law handed me a gun called a Taurus Judge, which is kind of self-defense porn. You can cross-load it with 410 shotgun shells and 45 long Colts. I didn't know what to do with it, but that was my first realization that this was very important to this man. And he didn't really care about football, and I care quite a bit about football, and I had to find a way to try to get to know him that did not mean his daughter. We had to come to some sort of a agreement and understanding. And I dove into guns, and I kept swimming.
Did you have, so you had no interest in firearms before then. What about now? Are you a firearms owner, RJ, and how many do you own?
I own two Glocks, Glock 17 and a Glock 26. I don't shoot anymore. I don't carry in public.
Cedric, what about you?
Yes, I certainly do keep possession of my firearms, and depending on what state that I'm living in, I make sure that I register them appropriately, and I receive the proper authority that's required by that state in order to be in possession of a firearm. And certainly if I choose to carry one upon my person, depending on the state that I'm in, I make sure that I abide by those laws.
Several of you have shared your stories with us about your relationship with firearms as people of color. One member of the 1A Text Club writes, "I'm in Utah, and I am as black as they get, and I happily and proudly carry a gun. I have a concealed weapons permit because nothing makes white people more nervous than seeing or knowing that a black man legally owns a gun. But there is no way in hell I'm open carrying it. I ain't getting shot today." Another member of the 1A Text Club writes, "I'm black. I own a gun. I took a class to obtain my CCW, my concealed carry permit, but I decided not to obtain my license to carry because of Philando Castile and Tamir Rice. In Ohio, if a police officer runs your license plates, they can see that you have a CCW. My fear is that if I am pulled over for a routine traffic stop, an officer will assume I pose a risk and treat me as such." Wesley Lowry, this might be a good place to bring you into the conversation, particularly because the text club member mentioned Philando Castile and Tamir Rice, both of whom were killed in encounters with the police that involved, in one case, what was a toy gun that appeared apparently to the officer to be real.
Certainly. Certainly. And I think that it speaks to kind of our developing conversation around police use of force and police shootings. When we think about when prior to Philando Castile and even prior to Tamir Rice, so much of our conversation was about unarmed people being shot and killed, right? And that this person must not pose a threat because they were unarmed. But then what we saw was a series of shootings where the person killed did possess some type of weapon, whether it be real or otherwise. And cases where you saw black men particularly being killed in shootings when they either were holding toy weapons or legally owned firearms. The Philando Castile video outside of Minneapolis, where he informs the officer that he has a legal firearm and yet still ends up being shot and killed. Tamir Rice and John Crawford, both in Ohio, cases with, in one case, a black boy, another case, a black man, who have toy weapons that the police believe to be real weapons. And so what it has raised is this question that we're now several years into grappling with of, do black men have the same rights as the rest of us? Does that Second Amendment apply practically to black men the way it does to everyone else? Or does the presence of that firearm, is that going to, because of the way that both law enforcement and so many other people view black men in our society, is that going to lead to additional fatal encounters?
And certainly worth noting that with Tamir Rice in the security camera video, if you watch, the police cruiser pulls up and basically the officer reaches out and opens fire on Tamir Rice, who was an 11-year-old boy, pretty much before the cruiser has come to a stop. We're speaking to Wesley Lowry, a national reporter with the Washington Post, RJ Young, an NRA-certified firearms instructor. His book is called Let It Bang, A Young Black Man's Reluctant Odyssey into Guns, and Cedric Alexander, a CNN law enforcement contributor, former police chief of DeKalb County. We welcome your questions and thoughts and stories as well, 1A at WAMU.org. We asked you to share your stories with us if you own or carry a gun. Here is a quick mashup of what two of you left in our inbox.
My name is Angela. I'm calling from Seattle.
My name is Derek, and I live in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
I am black, African-American, and I do own guns.
I am a licensed firearm owner, as well as I have a carry conceal permit.
I believe that black people should also exercise our amendment rights I realize that that's not respected by the police or others, and that people that look like me aren't normally considered the people that have gun rights.
I am concerned with the fact that if I was in a position where I had to draw my weapon to defend myself or someone else, that that may be perceived in the wrong light.
I make sure that we know how to use them so that when the situation arises where we can use them, that we're good shots, put it that way. Because I also realize that if I'm being assaulted or someone's breaking into my home, I can't count on the police to show up and have my back or my kids back.
Angela Derrick, thanks very much for sharing your stories with us. Cedric Alexander, as a law enforcement veteran, I'd love to get your take on that when we continue our conversation, particularly the concern that Angela expressed about not being able to count on the police to show up and know that they'll have her back. Think on that, and I want to get your thoughts on that when we continue. Also, Jim emailed, "The issue's not black or white people. It's who's a good guy or girl and who isn't. Split-second decisions are difficult. A man running with a gun in a crowd where a shooting just occurred is suspicious. It's not easy." Love to get your take on that as we continue with Cedric Alexander, RJ Young, and Wesley Lowery, and to get your questions and thoughts as well. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing the complicated nexus between guns, race, and law enforcement with criminal justice reporter Wesley Lowery of The Washington Post, former public safety chief Cedric Alexander, and RJ Young, the author of the memoir Let It Bang, A Young Black Man's Reluctant Odyssey into Guns. Today's conversation is produced in partnership with the public media reporting project Guns and America. You can find out more about it at gunsandamerica.org. We'd also love to hear from you. The Pew Research Center says about a quarter of gun owners are black. If you are among them, share what you know about being a black gun owner. Quite a few of you have said that you would never, ever open carry your weapon. What if you would? If you are comfortable open carrying, we'd love to know why. Share your stories as well. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Let me get to a few of your comments before I let Cedric and RJ jump back in. Davida tweets, "I am an African-American CCW holder, that's a concealed carry permit holder, and I do not carry outside my home simply because I'm afraid of getting shot by the shoot now, ask questions later police." Irwin tweeted, "As a veteran, a gun owner, and recognizably non-white, I have never experienced any act of suspicion or fear when using or carrying a weapon. That being said, why push my luck? The odds are in the house's favor." Cedric, I wonder how you would react to what we heard earlier in that clip with Angela and Derrick, particularly Angela saying that she's a gun owner because she's not sure she can trust the police in a moment where she's in danger.
Well, I think it's one thing we need to be clear of before I say anything else, is that race still is an issue in this country. And certainly when it comes to gun ownership and people of color, particularly African Americans, if we look at recent events over the last number of years that have occurred with Tamir Rice, for an example, and others, it certainly do create a great deal of pause of people of color, because they do feel, and there's even research that suggests, and I published a paper about 2 years ago in Harvard Yale Review, and there's significant research that strongly suggests that people of color, particularly African Americans, are more likely to be shot by white and black police officers than their white male counterpart. Now, that certainly speaks to a much deeper issue within our society, but it's a very realistic one. And whether it's perceived or real for those of color, it is a grave concern, because when you see these events occur over and over and over and played out on our televisions and played out on videos that are transferred around the world and around the globe, it creates a great deal of angst. It is not right. It is unfair, because anyone who's an American citizen, who's a gun owner, should feel if they want to be able to open carry, they should be able to do so. So it creates a bigger problem and a greater concern. But for me, as a former law enforcement executive, I particularly think it goes back to a number of things we have to think about. We can identify this issue, but we also have to identify some remedy to go along with it. And one is, it's how we recruit police officers today around their own sensitivity and their own bias and unconscious, implicit or explicit biases that we all of us may have. It's how we recruit, it's how we train, and it's how we supervise. And those are going to be three of the variables that I think are going to be critically important in order to people of color, particularly African Americans, to be able to feel like any other American in this country, they can rightfully and legally carry their firearms as stated by their particular state that they may happen to live in.
Yeah, Cedric, I believe in our past conversations, you talked about that as well, as about how it's partly the internal responsibility of law enforcement agencies to be mindful of the people that they bring in, the way they bring them in, the way they prepare them to hit the streets, and then the way that they deal with problems as they may arise. RJ Young, I wonder what your reaction was to what we heard from Angela and Derek, particularly this idea that this is a right, that African Americans have just as much right to exercise as anyone else, and also the concern about being able to fend for oneself in case law enforcement doesn't come to your rescue.
Black folks fighting for equal rights is nothing new, and having to live in a world where you're constantly on edge about what the government that is supposed to protect you is going to do is also nothing new. So I understand it. I was raised in it. I'm from Tulsa. I was raised in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. I live in Panama City, Florida. I understand. But I don't have time for law enforcement to figure out what's wrong with it. I don't have time for the recruitment to change. I'm 31, man. You know, the folks that you were talking about to open this show, like, Jamel Robertson and Emantic, I mean, they're my age. You know, we're not talking about dudes that have lived into their 40s and 50s. We're talking about millennials. We're talking about me. And I'm not going to give anybody any opportunity to believe that I'm already worse in their head. Joshua, man, I got dreads. I got 18 tattoos. I wear Jordans. I don't get to walk around saying I'm going to school to get a PhD. You know, that I love football, that I'm an Eagle Scout. No, people are going to make a spot judgment, and they're going to do something about it because they're terrified and afraid. And because I'm terrified and afraid, I'm not going to give them any more opportunities to think that I'm bad. And one way that you can think somebody is bad is them having a firearm, because it's like having Thor's hammer on your hip. Everybody's got Thor's hammer on their hip. Now, imagine trying to go up to Thor and say, hey, man, why don't you put down the hammer? You know, it makes us all kind of, you know, edgy. He'd look at you like you're crazy and say, no, you go get your own hammer. So we got a bunch of folks walking around with hammers, and I just decided to put mine down.
That's got to be a complex relationship, though, RJ. I mean, you do have a Second Amendment right to carry, you know, depending on where you are, you know, laws on concealed carry and so forth. But I wonder how you kind of came to reconcile those things for yourself, knowing that openly carrying or even just owning a firearm could put you at more risk of being killed by someone in the heat of the moment, but at the same time, knowing that you as an American have the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms, like, was there a moment for you, RJ, when those two reconciled, when that kind of settled for you?
Sure. I know that, you know, a little over 100 years ago, maybe 130 years ago, it was illegal for me to have a firearm. Anybody that looked like me. Folks were breaking into other folks' houses to take guns from folks that look like me. So I keep guns, right, for that reason, because it wasn't granted. It was something that wasn't given to someone who looked like me, who had to fight for that right to have it. And I am not regular in that my grandmother put her body on the line, lost her business, sued the state of Mississippi and won so that I could put a piece of paper into a ballot box. So, yeah, I understand, and I get it. But I also talked with my grandmother before she passed about this, and she had always told me, you have to treat everybody's fear as if it is real. Because to not treat their fear like it is real is to incite their ire, is to make them furious, because you would feel the same. And she told me she never got anything done by threatening violence or being violent. Now, I have friends that have decided, like many of the folks whose comments you read, that they will shoot back. My mother is one of them, so that's even more complex. But it's not for me to tell you what you're going to do or not do with a firearm. And the Second Amendment, as it is quite, I'm getting upset about it because the Second Amendment does not go far enough in it for anybody at all. It's problematic.
Yeah, we've had some of those debates about kind of what the Second Amendment might look like in a revision. If I could, although I do like the tweet from one of our listeners, Bruce, who wrote, "My favorite meme shows a room full of armed people of color with a caption, 'If you are frightened by this, you don't understand the Second Amendment.'" Michael emailed, "The anecdotes are terrible, but may misrepresent reality. What are the number of shootings broken down by race?" Wesley Lowery, let me bring you back into this. We talked about Jamel Roberson, Emantic Bradford Jr. Do those incidents reflect the norm? Are they an aberration? What do we know about the numbers?
Sure. So it's interesting because these types of shootings of quote-unquote good guys with guns, are very hard to quantify. They don't happen that often, although when they happen, they do seem to happen more often with black victims. What you might also classify would be cases in which you see black police officers who are shot by their colleagues. Maybe once a year you hear a case like that, right? A plainclothes black officer responds, joins a case, and ends up either getting roughed up or in some cases shot by his colleagues. And so we don't necessarily have comprehensive numbers on these good guy with gun shootings. What we do have comprehensive numbers are on police shootings broadly, right? That we know how often certain people are shot by and killed by the police and how often other people are. Since about 2015, and this is from a database my colleagues and I keep at the Washington Post, since 2015, there have been about 4,000 people in the United States who've been shot and killed by the police. Now, when you consider their representation in the population, black Americans are not only more likely than white Americans to be fatally shot by police, black police shooting victims are also more likely to have been unarmed when shot by police, right? And so victims who pose less of a deadly threat to police who are black are more likely to be shot, right? And so about 14% of black people who are shot and killed by police were unarmed compared to about 6% of white people. And so, again, the reason that we bring up the unarmed paradigm in this conversation is not to say that, well, you know, just more people who are, you know, that white people are more likely to be armed when they're shot and killed by police. That is true. It's also saying, are black people who pose less of a threat, objectively less of a threat, someone who is unarmed, more likely to find themselves killed? Because what does that tell us about how black people are perceived even when they don't have a firearm? Yeah, one quick thing, you know, as I was listening to the conversation earlier about the Second Amendment and whether or not black Americans have this right to carry, which obviously in terms of the letter of the law we do, it reminded me of a quote from the writer, my friend Ta-Nehisi Coates. It's going to be a crude paraphrase, but I remember him talking once in a question and answer and saying something along the lines of, you know, to be black in America is to watch other people do things you know you never could do. And so, yes, of course, black Americans have the right to carry firearms. But again, black Americans know that we can't quite do everything that our brothers and sisters of different races might be able to do without suffering some repercussions. And it gets to this long-standing paradigm in black America about the deliberate decisions we make that are self-protectionist, and sometimes not doing things that we are otherwise entitled to do, if only as a means of trying to keep ourselves safe.
Well, and then America's history with guns, as was mentioned, is pretty, it's complex. It's a history that I'm not sure that a lot of us necessarily know. MB Berry Farm tweeted, "The only reason semi-automatic weapons and others were regulated in the first place was because the Black Panthers started to wear them in their marches." There's some truth to that. The Black Panthers protested with openly carrying huge semi-automatic rifles and said, you know, we'll protect ourselves this way if necessary. And the then governor of California, Ronald Reagan, passed a law that prevented them from doing so. Eric tweeted, "You're not speaking of the history of guns and the NRA for that matter in the U.S. as a way for the white population to quote unquote protect itself from Native Americans, slave revolts, and the perceptions of black crime." Quite a few comments about the NRA, which we should talk about now. L tweeted, "One of the things that makes me the most angry is the silence of the NRA following the shooting of Emantic Fitzgerald Bradford." And Amanda tweeted, "I'd love to hear about why the NRA didn't make a stink about Emantic Fitzgerald Bradford Jr." Now, the NRA has not released a statement about Bradford's death or Roberson's. It also took more than a year to say anything about the police shooting of Philando Castile. We reached out to the National Rifle Association and have not heard back. That invitation stands. But I'd like to play a quick clip from NRA TV, their online web channel. This is commentator Stacey Washington in a video that was posted in late November.
You can't lynch people who are armed. You can't burn crosses in the yards of people who are armed. So they really worked hard to make sure that blacks who were free couldn't buy and own firearms, because then they could defend themselves.
Commentator Stacey Washington speaking on NRA TV. Cedric Alexander, I'd love to get your reaction to what Stacey Washington just said. I mean, there's a little truth to that. I mean, lynching people, it's harder to lynch somebody who's armed and can protect themselves. So there's this kind of complex history there.
Well, it's not a little a fact to it. She's very factual in what she's stating. Look, here's part of the problem here, Joshua, we're having in this nation around guns and people of color feeling that they can comfortably carry a gun. If I have to think twice of someone who's African-American, a person of color, have to think twice about being able to be in possession of their weapon, whether it's in their vehicle, it's legal, it's on their person, it's legal. And they have to be concerned with whether I'm going to be hurt by law enforcement in their community if engaged is problematic. And what's make it a greater problem, not only for that person who's feeling that way, it also makes it a problem for law enforcement. Because what people will do, people will feel as if they're not treated fairly. People will become angry. And if someone feels they need to keep their gun at home because they have a fear of legal owning a weapon that they're going to be shot by police, then that creates angst, it creates anger, and it creates separation from police. And one problem we're having in this country at this very moment is trying to work relationships between community and police that are respectable.
Right.
Police is there to serve the community. The community is not there to serve the police. Police is there to serve the community. You're talking to someone who's been in this business for 41 years on and off, and someone who have led two police departments in cities, major cities in this country. So I think it's important to note in all of this, we have to be sensitive. We have to be aware. And what I would say to EJ is that, yes, RJ, is that we have to be able to select and train and supervise going forward. We have to find solutions to this very complex issue so we can talk it to death. But what are the things that we're doing going forward to make sure that every American in this country feel that if they carry a weapon, they carry a firearm, they're being legal,
right,
they are being safe, they have the right to do so and not be resentful towards their law enforcement, not separate themselves from their law enforcement because they're being treated unfairly. Yep. We have to get away from that as quickly as we can. There's a responsibility of police to be aware of those feelings.
Right.
But at the same time, I am very much aware of the threat that police do live up under every day. And we cannot minimize that either.
Before we go, I know we got to let RJ and Cedric go in just a moment, but one more quick comment from a listener. Harry emailed, I think if every African-American living in an open carry state registered and carried at least one firearm, then we would see comprehensive gun control legislation pass in Congress so fast it would make our heads spin. RJ, before we let you go, very, very briefly, where does your relationship with firearms go from here?
I am intimately involved with this conversation. That's where it goes from here. My responsibility is to myself and my family and trying to protect them in the best way that I know how, while also honoring what I believe in my core values. So where I go from here is how do we stop black men from being shot,
right,
and killed by the men that Cedric just pointed out are supposed to protect the service.
RJ Young, sports commentator and an NRA certified firearms instructor. His new book is called Let It Bang, A Young Black Man's Reluctant Odyssey into Guns. RJ, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks, Joshua. Fun.
And CNN law enforcement analyst Cedric Alexander, also former DeKalb County Public Safety Director. Cedric, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
In a moment, the federal government has not been tracking who or how many people are shot by police across the country, but that's about to change. Wesley Lowery will explain in a moment. Stay close.